But before we start, I just want to mention that yesterday, one of the greatest rabbis of our generation passed away, Rabbi Avadia Yosef. So I just want to mention, just briefly, just tell you a little bit, those who aren't familiar with who he was, what he did. I mean, unfortunately, nowadays, so much gets involved in politics. And if you look at any article in a secular newspaper, they pointed him as the leader of the Shas party in Israel, which is true. He was involved in politics, and he was the leader of the Shas party, spiritual leader. But in terms of his wisdom, his guidance, what he did for the Sephardi community, it was an incredible thing. Rabbi Yosef, he was born in 1920 in Baghdad. He lived there, I think, until he was 4 or 5 years old. It was just in his very youngest years. He moved to Israel. This is in the mid-1920s. And in Israel, his family was dirt poor. They had really nothing to their name. And he was a boy who really excelled at his studies in the yeshiva. And by the time he was 8 or 9 years old, he already had started memorizing books, even writing out his own notes, producing his own Torah thoughts. But he was so poor, his parents had to send him to work. And the rabbis from the yeshiva came to his parents to plead with them, you have to send his boy back to yeshiva. He said he's excelled so much. He's really the top of the class. He can do such great things with Jewish people. You have to send him back. And they were able to convince his parents to send him back to yeshiva again. But he was still extremely poor. The story goes, I don't know if it's a legend or a true story, but it definitely fits Rabbi Avadia Yosef, which is that they had no money to buy books. So what he would do is he would go to the local bookstore, and I don't know if he worked there or he would just stop in, but he would just memorize books in the bookstore. And when he'd go home, he had such a memory, he could memorize every single thing he read. They say that his personal library in his house, at the end of his life, had over 30,000 books, and he knew them all. I mean, knowing them means he knew them word for word in his memory. It's really something incredible, which you don't see these days. There was once a story that there were people who were trying to publish a certain book, and they had some manuscripts, and they're missing a few pages, but they figured, we'll call Rabbi Avadia Yosef, and he can help us find the pages that are missing. So he says, give me a few days. He gets back to them, and he had handwritten the missing pages, word for word, from his memory. And they asked him, when did you last see this book? He said, 26 years ago. So it had been 26 years since he had seen this Sefer. And he had in his memory, he could actually write, and he said he was only off by 8 words, in terms of the exact wording of the book. And that was the person who he was. If you ever look at his responsa, he published many Svarim. His responsa, when he's trying to answer a halakha question, touch every single possible source you could ever imagine. He'll quote hundreds of sources, and it was all from his memory. I mean, he's somebody who had the memory which was impeccable. I mean, he didn't miss a thing, he didn't forget a thing. And he's the one who really revived the Sephardi community in Israel. I mean, when the Jews started coming back to Israel, especially after the establishment of the state, the Sephardim came from the Arab countries, many of them, and the community was looked at as kind of a dwindling community. They didn't come in terms of, in the best religious shape. The ones who brought them in were more the secular Zionists. And really, in terms of the religious establishment in Israel, it was the Ashkenazi establishment that had the power, that was considered the leaders. A lot of Sephardim had to leave their own Sephardi heritage, and they turned Ashkenazi, because that's what was there. Rabbi Yosef was the one who stepped up to the plate, and he kind of restored the beauty and the grandeur of Sephardi tradition. And he became the leader, the undisputed leader of Sephardi Jews for the past, 60, 70 years, was Rabbi Yosef. Every single Sephardi Jew, submitted to him, listened to him in terms of his guidance, his halakhic authority. That's who he was. He's somebody who was able to take a community which was kind of falling apart and dissipating and being absorbed into the Ashkenazi world or into the secular world and bring them back to their great spiritual splendor as one of the parts of the Jewish people, the Sephardi community. So, and his son now is the chief rabbi, the current chief rabbi of Israel. He was chief rabbi himself for many years. But it's a loss to the Jewish people as a whole, whether you're Sephardi or not, that for having a person like that alive in our world who could memorize 30,000 books, who could quote for you any single part of the Torah, word for word, from memory, and had such a way to grasp every single part of the Torah, it's rare. We don't see it much anymore. And it's a tremendous loss to the Jewish people. So you have to think about what he's done. And really, the Sephardim had somebody like him who they all turned towards as their leader. Ashkenazi Jews haven't had that, I don't think, in many, many years. We've had our leaders, but not one person we can point to and say, he is our authority par excellence. But Rabbi Yosef was that for the Sephardi community. And now in his lacking, they don't have it either anymore. So we know We always look toward new leaders who can rise and guide us, but it's a tremendous loss for Jewish people. For those in Israel, those outside of Israel, Sephardim, Ashkenazim, even Ashkenazi rabbis, when it comes to answering halakhic problems, would always turn towards his books, whether they agreed with him or not in terms of how he ruled in a certain case. But he was a point of reference, for sure, because you couldn't ignore him. He knew so much, and his works encompassed so much Torah thought, you could not ignore Rabbi Ovadia Yosef's writings and his opinions. Some may have argued with him, but he couldn't be ignored, that's for sure. So that's the loss that we've suffered. I mean, he was 93 years old, he lived a long and productive and fruitful life, but every single great Torah sage passes away and leaves a mark on the world. So I just wanted to mention that before we begin with our normal scheduled program. But I'm sure as time goes on, more things will come out about him. They always put out biographies and books. You can probably look today at articles. The New York Times had an article about him, I think, already yesterday. All Jewish papers certainly will have articles about him.
Even the Post had one this morning.
Post had this morning, too?
Really?
Yeah.
Political figure.
Political figure, they say. They don't appreciate his religious significance.
They gave credit to him for being a religious leader, but to most of the secular world,
he's a political leader. Yeah.
That's what I mentioned in the beginning. Party.
Right, so as I said at the beginning, we focus on his politics, but New York Times focused on his politics also. You know, but in terms of religious significance, he really stands out for the Jewish people. They estimated, I think, 800,000 people at his funeral yesterday. I can't even imagine.
800,000
people.
To a million when they called Israel.
Yeah, that's doubles up to a million.
Where I was reading this, it said that's about a tenth of the population of Israel who was there. One tenth of the whole population. You know, that's probably including the Arabs, I assume, as well. But one tenth. But 800,000 people. That's the mark he made on society of Israel. I mean, I don't remember in recent history any funeral that large. I mean, when Rabbi Eliyashiv passed away last year, I think they said maybe 400,000 or 500,000. It was large, but 800,000 is astounding. I mean, you can imagine 90 people in one spot.
In one synagogue, yeah.
Yeah, well, I said, you already saw the pictures. Look online, the pictures. They're on the rooftops, the streets. They're hanging off. You know, people everywhere, just to show their respect to such a great person.
He said his son is the chief rabbi of Israel.
Yeah, he's the new chief rabbi.
Chief rabbi.
Yeah, the chief Sephardi rabbi.
Chief Sephardi. Yeah,
he's the new chief Sephardi rabbi, right.
But it's an article on him. It's for the next decade.
What, for his son? Is that how they appoint? I don't know how the appointment works.
They
appoint it for 10 years? Maybe it's a 10-year appointment. I don't know.
That's
yeah, it's a 10-year term for chief rabbi.
That's why they're politicized.
Uh-huh.
In the rabbinic community that it selects the chief rabbi.
It's more than a rabbinic community that selects the chief rabbi.
But it's a 10-year term.
Some political people vote as well to establish the chief rabbi.
He's certainly a gadol, but I mean, no one can match his father. I'm saying, I don't think a single person living in the past, 100 years has matched the second peak knowledge that Rav Ovadia had. I mean, his son's a great rabbi and a great leader as well. His son helped put together a lot of his svarim, and a lot of his works were that's uncompiled, and he was involved. But Rabbi Ovadia was something very unique that we were lucky to have in our generation, and that we lost. But I mean, the funeral, I think, began in the Old City. So if you can imagine those people trying to crowd into the Old City, I assume it was quite a scene. But the police were well aware what was going to happen, so they set up in some way security. And but I mean, I just can't picture 100,000 people gathering anywhere. Right?
800,000.
It's a lot of people. Yeah. But every single person wanted to show their respect to such a great man.
Even non-Sephardim, right?
Yeah, even non-Sephardim. I mean, and I think basically all the yeshivas in Israel took off to go to his funeral. Sephardi or Ashkenazi. And I'm sure.
Seminaries,
I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure everybody, I mean, I assume everybody took off, any connection. Even that, Sephardim as a whole are more traditional than Ashkenazim, even those who are not religious. So I'm sure every Sephardi in Israel more or less felt that connection and wanted to go to pay tribute to this leader. Ashkenazic Jews who are secular, many of them are very disconnected. Sephardic Jews are very traditional and connected despite, their observance level. So I assume that contributed a lot to that crowd of 800,000. But it's worthwhile to see, just even the pictures, to show that the respect people show such a great person. I mean, even in the non-Jewish world, you don't hear funerals that large. I mean, even funerals of presidents, things like that. I mean, 800,000 people is astounding. So, back to our regularly scheduled class. We began last week the discussion of karbanos, of offerings that are offered in the temple. And last week we gave kind of a basic overview of the meaning, of the message of Karbanos, how they relate to us nowadays, how we should view it. We talked about animal rights a little bit too last week. Today I wanted to go through just some particulars about Karbanos. It gets a little bit technical, I'll warn you, but I think it's important for us just to understand the terminology. All of us, you know, we can open up our Chumash, read part of the Torah. You know, we're committed to understanding what the Torah is telling us. We can hear the Parsha being read in the shul. And a lot of the terms just don't relate to us. We don't know what they mean. You know, you sit through several different Torah readings, and it could all just be way over our heads. So at least to have the basics down of some particulars of different sacrifices, I think, is worthwhile. And we'll throw in some of the message of these sacrifices as well. But just we'll go through some of the basics. There are many types of offerings. I'm not going to talk about all of them. But we'll talk about the more common ones, the more common terminology. And at least give us, you know, just to make us informed in, you know, in Jews who know basics of Torah thought is a very important thing. So we'll discuss today the animal offerings. You know, they had animal offerings, they had flower offerings. But we'll discuss the animal offerings. Also, they also had wine libations, is also part of it as well. But we'll focus on the animal offerings. And the basic animal offerings we'll discuss, there's four basic styles, we'll call them, four basic types. The first one is called an ola. Ola. Ola, we would translate as, I guess, an elevation offering would be the best translation. I'll see how the article translates this word, but I would say call it, I think, an elevation offering is how they would translate it. And we'll talk about this more in depth in a minute, but an ola essentially is entirely burnt on the altar. It's not eaten at all by a human being. It's all burnt up on the altar. Let's just see how the article translation is elevation offering. Yeah, because it's totally elevated. It all goes up to God. Nothing is left here for the human being. The next basic offering we refer to as a shlamim. Shlamim. A shlamim has the Hebrew word, the Hebrew root of the word shlamim is shalom. It's peace, or completion, whole. And the shlamim was unique in that everybody got a piece of it. Some of it went on the altar, some of it went to the owner, and some of it went to the Kohen. So everybody shared in the shlamim. The third type of common offering we refer to as a chatas. A chatas is a sin offering, which is brought for certain types of sins one would do. We'll discuss that soon. And the fourth type of offering, which is common, is called an asham, which is a guilt offering. And also that is brought for other types of sinning, which we'll discuss as well. Asham. I guess in English I would say O-S-H-A-M, something along those lines. O-S-H-A-M. It's a guilt offering. A guilt offering. Ashamed is guilty. Yeah. Ashamed. Right. So those are the four, I guess, basic offerings that an individual would offer. Now,
what was the
Ashram? Ashram is a guilt offering. So it's also for different types of sin. We'll discuss when each one applies. The
On those two last ones, the katas and the ashram.
Yeah.
Were they totally consumed or were they shared? Or?
Oh, so those were shared between the Kohen and put on someone's burnt on the altar. The owner would not, the Israelite owner would not have any of it. But it was shared by the Kohen and the altar.
In both cases.
In both the Ashram and the Chatas, yeah. These could all be brought by individuals. Also sometimes be brought by the community. There were communal offerings, such as the daily offering, the Karban Tummy was a daily offering. There's two offerings that are offered on the altar twice daily, no matter what. You know, rain or shine, Shabbos, Yom Tov, Yom Kippur, weekday, no matter what, there's two offerings brought every day called the Karban Tummy, the continual, constant offering. And those were a form of an ola. They were totally burnt up on the altar. And that was a communal offering for the entire Jewish people, which was brought twice daily, once in the morning, once in the afternoon. The Musaf offerings, then we talk about Musaf on Shabbos or on Yom Tov, that was an additional offering that was brought for Shabbos or holidays. And that was an Ola as well. Those are totally burnt up. An Ola. There's also, part of the Musaf was also a Chatas. There was a communal sin offering brought along with it. And there was one time during the year there would be a communal Shlamim. And that was only, yeah.
Was there a second Chatas you mentioned?
Along with the Musaf came a communal Chatas. Typically, not always, but typically, depends on the day. And then there, once a year, there was a communal shlamim, and that was only on Shavuos. On the holiday of Shavuos, we had something very unique, which is a communal shlamim offering. Usually, shlamim offering was only brought by individuals, but on the Shavuos, there was a communal shlamim offering. So I'm not going to get into, yeah.
Is the fire going all the time?
Yeah, the fire is burning all the time on the altar. According to most opinions, there's a mitzvah to keep it going all the time. And the Gemara tells us it's actually miraculous. It was a miracle that the fire came from the heavens and continued burning. Yeah.
Even on Shabbos.
Even on Shabbos. These are brought even on Shabbos. I mean, an individual cannot bring a carbon on Shabbos, but these communal offerings, like the tamid, the constant offering, could be brought on Shabbos. So the musaf, obviously, is made for Shabbos, is brought on Shabbos. I'm not going to get too much into the communal offerings. I want to discuss more the individual offerings, but they all come in these styles, meaning that you have a communal ola or individual ola, they would be brought basically with the same procedures. It was a matter of who was the owner and what was the purpose of it. But the ola could have been an individual ola or a communal ola. The same thing, the communal chatas, individual chatas also had similarities to them. There was a similar style offering. There were some differences. But overall, they're very similar offerings. Every karban will have some similarities, such as, obviously, they slaughter it. There was a shechita done, a kosher shechita. The main parts of every offering were the shechita, that's when they actually slaughtered it, the catching of the blood, the walking of the blood from wherever they slaughtered it to the altar, and then the sprinkling of the blood on the altar. Which, contrary to popular understanding, the main part of the sacrifice was not the meat burning on the altar, but it was the blood being sprinkled on the altar. The blood is considered the life force of the animal. The Torah says many times, Adam hu hanefesh, the life force of the animal, of the human being as well, physically, is our blood. Our blood is considered the life force. So when you bring a sacrifice, the main part is you're offering the life force of the animal to God, not just the meat, but God's taking the blood as well, which is the life force of the animal. So the main parts of the sacrifice would be the shechita, the slaughtering, catching of the blood, the walking of the blood to the altar, and then the sprinkling of it on the altar.
Some as well.
The one karban where the eating of the karban has special significance is the karban Pesach. We have the special Paschal lamb Pesach offering, which every single Jew had to partake in that and eat part of it. And there, the eating takes on special significance. Even with the shlamim, where you do eat part of the shlamim, the eating wasn't as significant. But for the karban Pesach, the Pesach offering, that's where the eating was especially significant. But that was the zrika, the sprinkling of the blood, was the main part of every single karban. Now, it was done differently. Like, each karban, we said different styles of karban. So, chatas, you sprinkle the blood with a certain procedure. And ola, a different procedure. Shlamim, a different procedure. So, I'm not going to go into every single detail, but when you say something is an ola, it's because the procedure of how to bring it varied. And a shlamim, the procedure is also different. Each one had a different procedure of how it was brought, both in terms of the eating, the burning, the sprinkling, with the handling of each sacrifice had to be done appropriately. So if you're a Kohen, you have to really know what you're doing, because you had to know who's bringing it, why is he bringing it, what's it for, and then how do I go ahead with the procedure. So the Kohanim had to be really up to a date on understanding how to offer these offerings. The offerings, some of them were brought from cattle or from sheep. I mean, you have to use a kosher animal, obviously. The animals which were used, based on the offering, would be either cows, sheep, lambs, or goats, in terms of animal life. Now, there were some offerings you could offer birds as well. The two birds which could be brought as offerings, in Hebrew, it is a tor or a b'nei yona. So the typical translation, I believe, is dove and turtle dove, I think is how they translate it in the Art Scroll translation. Again, translations are always hard to know how accurate was it. But in Hebrew, it's a tor, or a yona, or the two birds. And those were, again, usually, I can look at the article again, I think it's translated as a dove and a turtle dove in the article translation. Now, there were also some sacrifices which, if you were poor and cannot afford to bring an animal, you could also offer flour. And there were different styles of flour sacrifices as well. Sometimes the flour was offered just as flour, and it would be burnt on the altar, and the Kohanim would eat some of it. Sometimes they would make it into different types of breads or cakes. I mean, sometimes they had it where it was mixed with oil and it was baked, or put into a pan with oil. I mean, different ways of, you know, it could be a pancake or don't add sugar. It would be basically flour, water, and oil. But they have different styles of how they make the flour offerings based on what the person wished to do, based on the offering. But those who are poor and could not afford to bring an animal at times could bring flour offerings as well. That wasn't always allowed, depends on the situation, but that was also a possibility. So I was looking up the translation of the birds.
They have a chart of the carbon in the back.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
here, turtle doves or young doves are the translations here. So you have a turtle dove or a young dove. So there's actually a very, very easy to read chart in the back of the Archgold Stone Chumash discussing all the different offerings. Okay, so now let's talk about some particulars here. So the first one we'll discuss will be the Karban Ola. So the Ola we translate as the elevation offering. The Ola is could have been brought only from male animals, if it's an animal. If it's a bird, it could have been a female. But if you're bringing trying to bring an animal, as opposed to a bird, it has to be a male animal. The ola was skinned. It was cut up in a special way. They didn't just put the animal whole on the altar. They would skin it and then chop it up in a special way. And then the meat was totally burned up on the altar. The ola could be voluntary, but there were times where it was recommended to bring one, meaning that you could offer an ola just as a donation to God. I want to come closer to God. I want to offer of my own towards God. So I'm going to bring an ola into the temple. But an ola is also used as an atonement if one had neglected to perform positive commandment. So let's say you have somebody who didn't eat their matzah on Pesach, or somebody who did not put on their tefillin, and they wanted to have an atonement for neglecting that positive command, so an ola would fulfill the purpose of that atonement. Also, an ola was suggested to bring as an atonement if somebody had thoughts of sin. I mean, the person didn't actually carry out the sin, but they had some thoughts in their mind to sin, and then they stopped themselves. So an ola also could be used as atonement for that. Those are two different situations where an ola was used as an atonement. But also could be voluntary. One could just bring an ola because they chose to bring an ola. They wanted to offer God an offering, so they brought an ola.
Do they say anything to the children or when they come in as to why they're bringing it?
Well, the Kohen would have to know what sacrifice they want it to be.
Right.
I don't think they have to tell the Kohen which sin that they may have performed. I don't think they have to tell the Kohen that. But they have to tell the Kohen why they're bringing it, because he has to have the right intention and really go through it procedurally when he does it. So Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch points out, what's the message of an Ola? He says an Ola is a person who is striving to rise higher. I mean, this is something that's totally burnt up on the altar. It's referred to as the elevation offering. That elevates the offering, it elevates the person. So when a person wants to dedicate themselves more to God, raise their standards of observing Judaism, observing mitzvot, so that was something they bring an ola, because the ola is that image of the entire being presented up to God. And as we said last week, a karban is an image for a person. You're supposed to see yourself in the karban. You're supposed to see yourself that this you're kind of living vicariously through this animal. And that could be you, that should be you, burning on the altar. So when you see the entire animal on the altar, that's an image of the person being totally elevated to God. So therefore, Rav Hirsch points out, at times, we want to be able to show our full motivation. We want to be able to raise our standards. As we said, it's an atonement for neglecting a positive command. So somebody who, based on their laziness or lack of interest, did not fulfill a positive commandment, so ola atones for that. And ola shows that I'm going to raise my standards, raise myself up, and connect to God on a much more dedicated level. Be dedicated entirely towards God. That's the image of an ola.
Yeah, but the same deserves the death penalty. I mean, that's you being burned up.
No, so not necessarily death penalty. It's not necessarily death. As we mentioned last week, not necessarily death penalty, but it's to see that the physical is being offered totally up to God. I'm taking, I'm taking this animal, which is the physical part of myself, it could be, and I'm dedicating it. Right, because that's the message of ola, is that it's a total elevation. Now, so that's an ola. The next common sacrifice was a shlamim. A shlamim, as we said before, the root word of shlamim is shalom, shalem. The word shalom in Hebrew, we use it for hello, goodbye, but the root of that is shalem, it's completion, right? Shalem, shalom, completion, and really shalom is referred to as peace as well. Shalom is peace, because peace means all the pieces fit in. There's a shleimus, there's a completion, there's a wholeness to it. So shlamim is that there is, everybody joins in, there's peace, right? Everybody gets a part of this, you're making peace between God, between the Kohen, between yourself. It's, everyone's joining together as one when you have a shlamim. So the shlamim, the fats are burnt on the altar, certain parts of it are burnt on the altar. the Kohen gets to take from the Shlamim the Chazeh and the Shok, the breast and the thigh, and he gets to eat that. And the owner gets the rest of the meat. That's how Shlamim works. So everybody gets their part in the Shlamim. And a Shlamim was brought totally as a voluntary karban. A Shlamim, I don't think we find a source of a Shlamim as an atonement anyway. But that was totally, you want to volunteer something to God. You feel like you want to come closer to God, you're motivated, you want to do something which is going to help promote and move you along your service of God, your relationship to God. So at that point, you would bring a Shlamim, that's going to be your offering. As an interesting note, the Jews had to all go to the temple three times a year on the three pilgrimage festivals, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot. When the Jews went to the temple, they had a mitzvah at that point to celebrate the Yom Tov, which was through eating meat of sacrifices. So Jews would bring what's called a chagiga, which was the holiday sacrifice. And also, in order to have meat for all their meals, they would offer additional offerings called shalmei simcha. Basically, shalmim of happiness. So it was a carbon shalmim for happiness purposes, to bring joy to your yantif. So therefore, you know, you want to have some lamb chops for yantif, you'd offer that as a sacrifice to God, and you get the lamb chops. You want to have a steak for yantif, you bring a cow, offer that to God, you get to eat the steak. You know, that's how it would work. But it would be holy meat from a sacrifice, and that would be how we would create our simchas yantif, our joy of a holiday, when we went up for the pilgrimage to the temple three times a year. So those are all brought in the forms of shlamim. So one had to have that meat for their mitzvah of enjoying Yom Tov, but it was brought in the form of a shlamim. So the Kohen would get some. Some's burnt on the altar, and then the person gets the rest.
And Ola could be voluntary completion because you felt like it.
Right, but also had atonement purposes to it.
Right.
Right.
And a shlamim is also voluntary. So
right.
What's the difference? How do we use the two different kinds to achieve different?
So that's what I'm going to talk about next. Good question. So we mentioned Rav Hirsch on the Ola. Rav Hirsch said the Ola is when you are trying to raise your standards, elevate yourself up to God, and become totally dedicated. Rav Hirsch says that a shlamim is a different message. A shlamim is the feeling that I feel very, very appreciative and happy of what God has given me. You know, everything in life seems to be fitting in. God has granted me so much goodness and kindness in my life. So I want to celebrate with God. I want to bring God more into my daily life. So therefore, I give a shlamim, which means basically I'm eating at God's table. I have some of God's meat. He's sharing the meat with me. The Kohen's having the meat with me. We're all having meat together. It's like you're making a meal with God in a certain sense. And it's the idea is this idea of shalom, of peace, of completeness, not because a person feels lacking or feels like they're a sinner, but it's the opposite. A person feels so appreciative and so happy with their life, they want to celebrate with God. That's the concept of bringing a voluntary shlamim. So I appreciate so much that what God has given me, I just want to bring God into my life in a stronger way. So I partake of a meal with God. And that's the terminology that the Gemara uses for eating meat of a sacrifice, is you are zochen mishulchan gavol. You're eating from the heavenly table, basically. So this is God's heavenly food at your table. That's what you're doing when you're eating a part of a sacrifice. So that would be the feeling of a shlamim. So sometimes a person feels lacking. We feel that we have to raise the bar. You know, we haven't done our best. You know, we have our shortcomings and our lacking. So that would be a place to bring an ola. And that's where you're expressing that I'm not yet worthy of eating of your meat, God. I want to dedicate it all to you. But then sometimes we feel very satisfied and complete. We want to maintain, we want to appreciate the relationship that we have with God. And we want to appreciate the life that God has given us. And that's when we might call a person to bring a shlamim, because that person is trying to express, I want to celebrate with God and celebrate all that I have. So you have those different emotions in bringing each voluntary karban. There is a form of a shlamim, which is referred to as a karban toda, a Thanksgiving offering. Now, the Thanksgiving offering was actually a shlamim, but it had some unique rules. A Thanksgiving offering, the Torah says if one wants to bring a Thanksgiving offering to God, so long with that offering comes 40 loaves of bread. Actually, some are matzah, some are bread, but basically 40 loaves of bread. And the shlamim, the normal everyday shlamim, you had 2 days to eat it. Every karban has its time limit on it. So the normal everyday shlamim, you have 2 days to eat. The toda, you have 1 day to eat. So essentially, when one would bring a karban toda, a Thanksgiving offering, they would have 40 loaves of bread plus an animal to consume. And they got to get it all done in 1 day. So they'd invite their friends and their family to join in. And it would result in a large festive meal of appreciation for what God has done for the person. The rabbis tell us there are four occasions which one has to bring Karban Todah. Arba Tzrichim L'Hodos, four people who have to give their appreciation to God and offer a Karban Todah. And it's somebody who has been healed from a life-threatening illness, somebody who has been freed from prison, somebody who has crossed the sea safely or crossed the desert safely. Those are the four categories.
Can you repeat them again, please?
Somebody's been healed from life-threatening illness, a serious illness, somebody who has been freed from imprisonment or capture, somebody who has safely crossed the sea or safely crossed the desert. For those who may be aware of the other halachic categories, we actually derive the rules of Birchas HaGomel, of Thanksgiving blessing, from this karban. The two are connected, the Gemara connects the two. And nowadays we can't offer the Thanksgiving sacrifice, but we do have Birchas HaGomel, Thanksgiving blessing, which typically is said when we read the Torah after somebody goes through one's situations, and that is modeled after the Karban Todah, according to most opinions. And the Thanksgiving offering. Should I repeat them one more time? You got them all?
Being healed from something like threatening, free from prison, safely crossing the sea, and then safely crossing the desert.
Yeah, right.
Desert and sea would be the same, or
it's
two different.
Right, they're two different ones.
I've seen this thing with someone who's very young, like we covered it. It's called Suda.
Asuras Hoda, right. So yeah, it's a concept from this also. There is a concept even nowadays that one who is saved from some dangerous situation should make a meal as an appreciation to God. Asuras Hoda, we call it, a Thanksgiving meal. And I know people who have been in very serious car accidents, have survived, who've made these meals, things like that, or have been very ill and have survived, and you want to show your appreciation to God, so you make a meal. So we can't do it nowadays with the karban, with this offering, but we can do it our own way to show our appreciation to God. In the bracha of HaGomel, the bracha we make when we do survive a dangerous situation, that is modeled after the Karban Todah.
That's even just flying, let's say, from Israel here. It could
right, so that's, there's a major discussion of modern authorities. It used to be crossing the sea was extremely dangerous, it was long, in a ship, you know. Now when you fly back and forth to Israel, you can go once every week, and it's, you know, there's barely a risk. So there's a big discussion amongst modern authorities if the bracha should be said over a plane flight overseas, or even, you know, a local plane flight, or over a desert. The common custom is to make the bracha if you've flown overseas, but there are different authorities who rule differently. You can consult your own rabbi if you have a question. But the common custom certainly seems to be that flying overseas would warrant someone to say Birchas HaGomel. So the Karban Todah was a form of ashlamim, which we partake in eating, but there'd be so much food to consume in one day, you'd have to invite your friends and family to join in, which means that you'd make a big meal to show your appreciation to God. That's how it would turn out. That's the Karban Todah. The next Karban, which was a common Karban, is a Karban Chatos, the sin offering. Now the sin offering is interesting because it wasn't brought for every single sin. It cannot be brought voluntarily. It had to be only for a specific sin the person has done. And if they did the sin, they have to bring it. But you couldn't volunteer a sin offering. And the type of sin that one bring a sin offering for was only if it was done unintentionally, not intentionally. If you did something intentionally, an offering's not going to cut it. Right? God says you need more than an offering if you intentionally sinned. But if one did an unintentional sin of the type that would have warranted the punishment of kares. Kares is considered one of the most severe punishments in the Torah. It means some sort of spiritual, spiritually being cut off from God. The soul has been disconnected from God in some way.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, I'll give an example. Kares may result in the physical world in somebody not having children, God forbid losing children. That's how the rabbis say, sometimes life being cut shorter in this world. And those are different manifestations physically of kares, but also means the soul is cut off from God. Now this is reserved for what we would consider some very serious violations in the Torah. Eating on Yom Kippur, for instance, would warrant kares. If you intentionally eat on Yom Kippur, that would warrant kares. Intentionally eating chametz on Pesach warrants kares. Those are some incestual relationships or inappropriate relationships would warrant kares. So those are different examples of kares. But some of them are considered some of the most severe sins in the Torah would warrant kares. Yes?
I used to be under the impression that if a person did kares, that was the end of the line. But more recently, correct me if I'm wrong, a person still can do teshuva.
Teshuva works, right. But teshuva works for kares. If you have to do a sincere teshuva, but teshuva works for everything. But we're talking about somebody sinned in a way which, had they done intentionally, would have warranted kaharis, but they did it unintentionally. So somebody eats on Yom Kippur, but he thought it was a different day. He thought Yom Kippur was Tuesday, and really it was Wednesday, right? So he mistakenly ate Yom Kippur. Somebody thought he was eating matzah, and it turned out to be bread, right? So he thought it was Pesach. You know it was Pesach. He thought you were eating matzah, and someone said, no, that was chametz. Oh no, what did I just do? So those are situations that would warrant a karban chatas. Somebody isn't aware of the laws of Shabbos and violates Shabbos. So they weren't aware of the laws. It's unintentional. They weren't aware of the laws of Shabbos. That would warrant the karban chatas. Somebody thinks that, gets his calendar mixed up and thinks that today is Sunday, really it's Saturday. And then he violates Shabbos. So that also would warrant a karban chatas. Yeah?
What about, let's say, during the Holocaust and people, all they had was bread and they couldn't smuggle in, they had some say they come on.
Right. If your life's in danger, it's a different story. So that's your life's in danger. So those are all examples that would warrant a karban chatas. Again, if somebody intentionally violated these mitzvahs of the Torah, so then the karban is not going to cut it. They can't bring the karban, and they need a much bigger tshuva process to be forgiven by God for an intentional violation. The karban chatas could be brought from many different types of animals. I didn't mention the shlamim also could be brought from different animals, male, female. Chatas as well, depending on the situation, also could be brought from many different types of animals. I'm not going to get into the specifics. But the idea of a chatas is that some of it is burnt on the altar, and some is eaten by the kohen. The actual owner did not eat the chatas in any way.
Sorry about that.
I was wondering where that was coming from. Yeah. The owner would eat part of the chatas, only the kohen would, and some of it would be burnt on the altar. The chatas is actually a very special privilege for a Jew, because the person has sinned. Every sin, even unintentional, affects the soul. And God could have said, tough luck. God could have said, there's a lot more you have to do. But God made it very easy for us. He said, just escape. Go get yourself a lamb, break the temple, offer it up sincerely, and you'll be forgiven for that sin. And you'll be cleansed of that sin. And it's a special attention and relationship given to the person who sinned. Because God wants that person to come back and be cared for and understand that even if you made a mistake, you're accepted back into the fold once again. So that's the concept of the karban chatos. There's a medrash that says that what should one do to a sinner? So it says that first God went and asked wisdom. That's a metaphor. God wanted to ask wisdom. Wisdom, what do you do to a sinner? So wisdom said, he quotes a verse, Nefesh echotas hitamus, the sinner's soul should die. You perform a sin, there's an effect on the person, and once the effect is there, you can't take it back. God forbid somebody kills someone else, you can't bring the person back. It's over. Whether you did it intentionally, unintentionally, whether you regret your action or didn't, the person is gone. As they say, you can't put the toothpaste back into the tube. It's over. It's all over. So wisdom says the person sins, that's it. There's nothing they can do about it. But the Torah says, no, the sinner is allowed to bring a karban chatas. The sinner can bring a sin offering. And that sin offering is going to be able to rectify the problem and to fix the problem within the person's soul. Obviously, if the sin was a murder, you can't bring the person back to life. But at least in terms of the effect it had on the person who did it, that can be rectified in some way. And it's all unintentional we're talking about. Intentional murder requires a lot more teshuva than just bringing a lamb into the temple. Yeah?
Sorry. Unintentional murder, what we call manslaughter.
Yeah.
Calls for exile to one of the cities of refuge.
Yeah.
Does it also require korban chatas?
You
mentioned
these
other things, but...
Correct, right. That particular question... I'm not sure of the answer. It could be there's a distinction of manslaughter versus unintentional murder, meaning that at the time where you think that unintentional murder might be that you thought murder, in this kind of case, you thought murder was okay to do, versus that you lost control of your car.
You thought this was the fellow who had been sentenced by the big din and it turned out it was that guy.
Right. So I'm not sure the answer to the question. It's a good question. I'm not sure. Clear murder was a bad example. But... the other example is certainly you don't have the city of refuge to go to. All those examples, the person ate Yom Kippur, Jew ate Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is considered the day of the year that every Jew is drawn towards service of God. It's looked at as the pinnacle of the Jewish year in terms of holiness. A Jew who accidentally ate Yom Kippur, so it has an effect on the person's soul. So that effect, logically, we can't necessarily fix. You know, there's been damage done. But God says a person can bring a sacrifice, a chatos, and that will allow the person to have atonement and be cleansed of that sin. Chatos, I don't want to go into too many details, but a chatos can come also in many forms, such as there was a unique chatos that we brought by the king, if the king sinned, or by the Kohen Gadol. If the Kohen Gadol sinned, the high priest sinned, he'd have his own unique chatos. There was a chatos that could the may have to be brought by the entire court. Let's say the court ruled incorrectly. The Sanhedrin ruled incorrectly, and people acted on their ruling, and they found out that they made a mistake, and it was incorrect. It wasn't the Torah actually the mandate in the situation. So there was a special chatos he brought on behalf of the court. That was done in a certain way, in a special way. So you had different types of chatos, but in general, in certain, and there are other sins, different than we discussed, that require their own special form of chatos. But just to keep it more general and not get into so many details, but chatos is the idea of a sin offering which allows a person to have atonement for that which they've done. The chatos that we discussed, when you do such a severe crime that would have warranted kares, that had to be brought from an animal. But there are a few other sins that mandate a chatos, which we refer to as an olev yored. It's a variable offering, meaning that you bring a chatos based on your own financial situation, you can choose what to bring. I mean, if you were very wealthy, you'd bring a cow. If you were, let's call you middle income, you would bring maybe a lamb or sheep. And if you're very poor, you could bring flour. You could bring a bird and then a flour offering. I mean, those would be different gradations of it.
Can you read that one more time?
Somebody who's very wealthy would then maybe bring a cow. Somebody who's less wealthy might bring like a sheep or a bird, and he goes all the way down to flower offerings.
Sliding scale offerings.
So certain sins, not ones as severe that we discussed, but certain sins would require, would allow the person, and again, you have to be honest, God knows who you are and what you're bringing. But those offerings would be on a sliding scale based on your own financial position in life. Let me clarify one second. I mentioned the cow as the most wealthy level. Could be there was no cow for that offering. I can't remember if the top of the level was the sheep or the top level was the cow in there. I'm not sure. Let's look that up. But certainly it went down to the birds and the flower afterwards. But I can't remember if the top of the line was a cow or the top of the line was just a sheep. Just the one more offering is the Karban Asham, is the guilt offering. Now, the guilt offering is a very fascinating thing because there is two different forms of an Asham guilt offering. Referred to by the rabbis, one's called an Asham Vadai, a certain guilt offering, and one's called Asham Talui, an uncertain guilt offering. The certain guilt offering was brought in five situations in the Torah. I'm not going to get into detail, I'll just list them for you quickly. It was brought by a Nazir. Someone had taken the vow of a Nazir, not to cut his hair, not to become impure, not to drink wine. When he finished his term as Nazir, he would bring a certain guilt offering. A Metzora, somebody who contracted the disease of Saras, which we say, the translation of leprosy is a very bad translation, but somebody who developed this disorder on their skin based on their sins, referred to as saras, he would bring a guilt offering. Me'ila is somebody who had benefited from the items of the Beis Hamikdash of the temple in an inappropriate way. He would have to bring a guilt offering. Somebody who had stolen money and sworn falsely about the theft and then admitted would have to bring a guilt offering. And the fifth situation is a very strange, unique situation referred to as Shifcha Charufa.
Excuse me, what was it for?
Was somebody who had stolen.
No, but
it's a name. It's a thief. I mean, it's a thief who swore falsely. It's a thief who swore falsely. He swore falsely about the theft, and then he admitted it after the fact. He'd bring the Asham. He'd bring a certain Asham. And fifth case is a very unique case, a little complex, referred to as Shifcha Charufa, which is the designated maidservant case, which just, in short, is if somebody had a non-Jewish maidservant who actually halachically is partially Jewish for many different ways and had designated that maidservant to marry his own Jewish son, and then she has an adulterous relationship, that's called Shifcha Charufa. And that's a whole separate discussion or interesting situation. But in that situation, there also would be a certain guilt offering brought. But what I want to focus on is the uncertain guilt offering. We call it Asham Talui. It's a guilt offering for when you're uncertain. And this is a very interesting case. Somebody who had performed an act which they're unsure if they violated a mitzvah that would have warranted kares. So we discussed, let's say, We talked about eating chametz on Pesach, let's say. Right? Say chametz on Pesach warrants karis, right? So let's say someone's unsure if they eat chametz on Pesach. So in a case where you're unsure, you don't bring a chatas, because a chatas only if you know you did something wrong. An asham talui, the uncertain guilt offering, is if you're unsure. You don't know. You think you may have done something wrong. You know, the classic case the Gemara gives, there are certain fats of animals which you're not allowed to eat, and actually weren't karis. Certain fats, the same fats that are burnt on the altar of a sacrifice, we're not allowed to eat even to this very day. If any kosher slaughterhouse pulls those fats out. And let's say you have in front of you, you know, two different pieces of meat. And one of them, you know, was a forbidden fat, and one of them didn't have forbidden fat. And you ate one, you don't know which one you ate. You don't know which one you ate. So you're unsure. Maybe you ate the forbidden fat, maybe you didn't. So that case would warrant an asham talui, this uncertain guilt offering. Now what's fascinating about this offering is the Torah mandates what it should cost. And it says it should cost 2 shekel. 2 shekel in the Torah's term is, the art scroll note says, is about 38.4 grams of silver. So it's a fairly expensive offering, 38.4 grams of silver. And commentaries point out that it's an interesting thing. The guilt offering, which is a case where you weren't sure if you sinned, is very expensive. The chatas, the typical sin offering, doesn't have to be so expensive. So the unsure offering is actually more valuable than the offering you bring if you're sure you sinned. So why do you have that distinction? So one of the great early commentaries, Rabbeinu Yonah, he writes that there's a very important psychological reality that a person has, which is that if you know you did something wrong, you feel bad, you regret it, you'll sincerely repent, you know, it hits you, because I know I did something very wrong. If you're unsure if you did something wrong, then, you know, you rationalize, probably I was okay, yeah, I probably ate the right thing, I'm not so concerned about it. So in a case like that, since a person won't feel so distraught of what they did because they're unsure if they did anything wrong, the Torah mandates a more expensive sacrifice to show you that, you know, you did something which was irresponsible. You possibly violated the Torah in a very, very serious way. You have to realize that. So we're making you bring a very expensive karban to repent for what you've done. But the psychological reality in a person is that if you know you did something wrong, you regret it. If you're unsure you did something wrong, you don't regret it so much. And then you start justifying your actions. So that's what Rabbi Yonah explains. Just finish up here. The most offerings had along with them, you had to bring with your offering flour and wine libations as well. There are some exceptions, other unique karbanos which we didn't discuss. We're not getting into everything right now. So I want to add in one more point, which is there's a famous idea that Rashi quotes, which is concerning the flour offerings. The flour offerings were typically reserved for those who were poor. And somebody who's poor, even offering up a little bit of flour would be very difficult. So when the Torah introduces the flour offering, the Torah says, nefesh ki akriv mikem, a nefesh, a soul that offers from within you a flour offering. So Rashi picks up on the point, why does the Torah say the word soul right here? It doesn't say it's a person, it says a soul that brings a flour offering. So Rashi says, because a poor person who offers flour, God views it as if they offered their soul on the altar. Because if you're wealthy, and you bring, you know, a cow worth $5,000, not a big deal, because you have plenty of money in the bank, you have plenty of food for the month, you're okay. If you don't have food to put on your table next week, and you're offering a loaf of bread to God, that's offering up your entire existence to God, because you can't afford it. You know, the flour for the poor man is worth much more than the cow is to the wealthy man, because this could be his meal next week. This could be a meal for his kids next week. You know, he doesn't have the money. So when God sees a poor person bringing flour, God sees that the poor person himself has been offered his whole soul on the altar, because his whole being has been offered to God in a situation. And the bottom line is, it's quoted in the Mishnah. So you say, Echad Amarbe, whether you bring a lot, whether you bring a little, as long as your heart's towards heaven, that's the important point. So when it comes to offerings, you know, God sees through the person. God knows, why are you bringing this offering, that offering? Are you sincere, insincere? Do you have money to bring more? Do you have money to bring more? And as long as our hearts are towards heaven, then everything is accepted by God, and that will bring us our relationship and our atonement. So that's the bottom line. So there are definitely some that we did not touch on, so hopefully you got at least a basic gist of how the karbanos work, of specifics. And probably next week we'll move on to a different topic. I don't want to spend too much time on sacrifices. But
now you talked about flour. What about wine? You mentioned wine and then didn't drink.
Wine is a libation. Right. It's a sacrifice.
Right. Wine is poured onto the holy altar. Yeah.
Disabled.
flour and wine. So yeah. I was wondering the same thing.
Right. So wine was never brought on its own, I don't think. Wine was always brought alongside the other sacrifices. Like when they would bring the daily offering, they would offer a wine libation. When an individual brought their carbanos, sometimes that would require a wine libation along with it. I don't think that wine was ever offered on its own. I don't think you could show up with a bottle of wine to the temple. That would be along with something else.
That'd be wine or oil, right?
Well, the oil would be mixed into the flour offerings. The oil was never brought on its own.
So what did they pour the wine onto the flour?
The wine they pour into a hole on the altar. With the flour offerings, the way they all worked, I didn't say this, the Kohen would take his three fingers, he would scoop it out, a very level scoop, there's a skill on how to do it, and that we burned on the altar, what he scooped out, and the remainder of it, the Kohen would get to eat. That's how flour offerings worked. The Kohen's own personal flour offerings all had to be totally consumed on the altar. He would get to eat his own flour offering. But if a normal Israelite bought a flour offering, he would scoop out this level scoop in his hand, he'd burn that on the altar, and then the rest would be eaten by the Kohen.
Did the Kohen have to offer the flour offering?
Yeah, I mean, he's subject to the same rules as everyone else. So.
No, I mean, if a person...
Oh, yes, he would have to do that. That's something Kohen has to do. Yeah. The only thing a non-Kohen could do, a non-Kohen can actually do the slaughter. The Shechita was kosher to be done by a non-Kohen. But the rest of the steps of Karbanos were all done by the Kohanim.
By non-Kohen, you'd mean a Levi?
No, even an Israelite, or anybody. Yeah. And just about the wine offerings, you know, the concept of the Levites singing in the temple, that was done during the wine libations. So along with the wine came the song.
It's Oktoberfest, right?
that's what it was. The wine, you know, in a metaphoric sense, brings that joy to the person, and that's where the music came out as well, was during the wine offerings. But the wine was poured in the hole in the altar. We mentioned last week that once a year, or one time during the year during Sukkot, they would offer water on the altar as well. They poured down that same hole, and then the water down through the second hole. They poured water on the other hole. So that was only on Sukkot, the water offerings. But the rest of the year, they'd have the wine offerings. That was done on a daily basis, the wine offerings, the wine libations. I think that covers most of the basics of the carbon. Again, there's a lot of details